Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com. I'm Bob Crawford. Ben, you're done.
I'm done.
Summer break.
Some type of break. It's the week between whenever my regular classes end and my online class begins.
Oh, wow.
Would you like to take a history class from me where you have less direct interaction with me than you have listening to my podcast? Well, sign up for History 2010.
Yes, I want to take it, but it's only a 200 level course, and I can't take a 200 level course.
Oh, sorry. That's because you're in grad school now, Bob.
That's right.
Can't be working backwards, man.
Can't be doing 200 level classes. Although yeah. I could probably use a few.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that I loved about being a TA in graduate school was that you would then go in and work with somebody on a general education class. And it always like brought all the kind of like disparate specified things you were learning back into the master narrative. So Bob, you know, in a year, if you want to come to MTSU and take my history 2010 or 2020 classes, you were always welcome.
And teaching those classes is how you really learn history, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
That's how you learn it, but repetition.
It's the repetition, but it's always like you write it the first time and you have the narrative and then the new stuff comes out. And that's when it gets fun because your students get to see you talking in class like, until this semester, here's how I taught this. And then this new book just came out. And let me tell you about how that changed the way that we saw things. And it's, man, that Grant biography in particular, man, it was the new one, just blew my mind.
Well, speaking of having your mind blown, and normally my segues are not very good. However, this week it's very appropriate because we spoke with Tom Marshall, principal lyricist for the band Phish.
Yes, and I don't know. I mean, we speak to a lot of fantastic people and a lot of fascinating people. Tom is like, he's fascinating in like three different ways that are fairly distinct.
Yeah, yeah, he is a true Renaissance man.
Yeah, he writes the lyrics for Phish. He's like an IT guy that works at like these huge companies, and he's worked on startups. And all along, I don't really think about a lot of times, you know, a guy who's doing IT for a big corporation also being like an amazing poet. But as it turns out, people are more fascinating than we expect sometimes.
And he's also the man who co-started our network.
That's exactly
Osiris.
Right.
Osiris.
He is the COO and co-founder of Osiris. And loving this thing.
That's right. Osiris is a global community connecting passionate music fans with podcasts about music, artists, and culture. And I guess, Ben, Road to Now, we're part of the culture, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And we got a musician in our podcast and a former musician in our podcast. But yeah, we're culture. But we have so many different ones as well. Like we have Daddy Unscripted, which is a parenting podcast about fathers. And a new comedy podcast, which recently joined, which I am going to selfishly plug right here because it is co-hosted. Two of the co-hosts are Gary Fletcher and Sean Parrott, who are my co-hosts and writers for Perfect Timing, the comedy game show that I've been doing now for 3 years. Two of the funniest people I know. And I told RJ about him. RJ listened and was like, yes. So if you like comedy, I'm not on this podcast, by the way. It's just my friends. So if you are looking for a good comedy podcast that is not safe for work, but will crack you up, go check out Which Is Better. So funny.
And Tom has two podcasts of his own, Under the Scales and The State of the Garden. So we in this episode, we talk about those podcasts. We talk to Tom about so many things, about his writing influences, growing up, some of his favorite books. And actually, we talked for an hour and a half, which I think is the longest interview we've ever done. I think the first one we did with Doug High was well over an hour, but I do believe that this Tom Marshall interview was very long, and we had to cut it short. So just, can you imagine that? We could have spoken with Tom for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours. He's just an amazing guy, and he's just so smart and knowledgeable on so many different topics.
Yeah, and I hope that one day we can change the title of this to Part One, because there will be many more discussions with Tom to come. And for all the things that this podcast has been amazing, we got to meet great people. One of the coolest moments that I've had was listening to the guy who wrote the words that I have sung in my life so many times. I still sing in my head sometimes now, say that he likes our podcast. That was so awesome.
Could it be the overhead view is of me in a maze? Could that be it?
I think so.
That song has been my theme song multiple times in my life, and it continues to be one of the, it's so true. So please enjoy this episode with Tom Marshall. And if you are a patron of ours, you will get to hear about 30 minutes of this interview that we had to cut out.
Yes, because we try to keep things tight, but we know the patrons like it, and we like to give you guys some extra things. So we hope that whenever you listen to the full uncut episode on Patreon, it will have you bouncing around the room.
Oh, very nice. Wraps round me like a blanket tight, gets
inside your seat and kills. Ram Zur Records is pleased to announce the release of the Ruin Brothers debut album, All My Shades of Blue, produced by Rick Rubin. Download All My Shades of Blue on June 1st, or get your vinyl via Ram Zur Records on June 22nd. More by visiting ramzorrecords.com.
Marshall, welcome to The Road to Now.
Oh man, I'm so happy to be here. Hi Bob and hi Ben. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great, and we're very excited to speak with you. We've got a lot we want to get to, so let's just jump right into it, okay?
Before you do, though, I want to say that I'm really, really happy with... I want to thank you guys for joining the Osiris family of podcasts, and it's really cool to... RJ and I have always said that we're a family of music and culture podcasts. And recently, and I have to again thank him, he's a really cool guy, Michael Shields did a sort of a feature on some of the non-music ones, some of the culture-only ones in our family. And of course, this great podcast and two others were featured. And that's on his podcast, Beyond the Margin, which is a great podcast, too. But it was a really great intro, and people should listen to that and check you guys out that way.
And I really love how you say a family, because it's like today Ben and I are interviewing one of the bosses in a way. But when you say it's a family, you know, it kind of feels a little better. You know, it's a little more relaxed.
I agree. We call RJ the pod father because he's the longest the longest one. So that enforces the family theme as well.
Also, I wanted to say that it's amazing as well, because I think the newest Osiris podcast is Which Is Better, which is a comedy podcast featuring two of my very good friends in Nashville who I do the comedy game show Perfect Timing with and have written for 2 years. So this is like an amazing, it's like not just a regular family, it's like a family and an extended family, and everyone's kind of bringing the people they know that are talented in. It feels great.
That's the Which Is Better one?
That's it.
Yeah, I listened to that. It's hilarious. That's like an incredible, like the mic is turned on in almost in like a cabin kind of thing. Awesome. And it's awesome, their discussion about like King Kong versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
And it's it brings in references that you wouldn't expect, shall we say.
Agreed.
Yeah, you know, it's like being a part of this community, and Ben and I were so excited to join Osiris. I've been listening to all the shows, you know, within the network. I'm listening to more podcasts now, and I'm listening to, you know, I take in a lot of history and politics, and it can weigh on you a little bit. And listening to Helping Friendly podcast and Under the Scales and Michael's podcast, it has helped me get a much needed break and gain a better perspective on a lot of other important things in life. And so being a part of the network, it strengthened numbers for Ben and I, like to be now connected to a larger community. But it's also edifying personally. So again, thank you to Tom and thank you to RJ.
Well, that's nice of you to say. And the only downside I've seen so far, you're right, it strengthens the community. All the podcasts have been really kind to each other in terms of pushing each other on social media and elsewhere within their podcasts as well. The only detriment to me has been lack of sleep, because, as you say, there's a lot to catch up on. You guys are very prolific with your podcast generation, and they keep coming, and I keep listening and try to stay on top of it. But it's very, very difficult, but extremely edifying, especially with the vast the broad topics that they encompass.
Tom, I think of you as a Renaissance man, and it's so funny because I was doing research on you, and I know you've got your hands in a lot of different things. You've taken a lot of different paths in life, and I think back to my days on, you know, being a fan of the band Phish and going on tour and going to shows and hanging out in the parking lot. And you know, there's all this myth and legend, right, attached to any band, and it would be like, you know, well, Tom faxes Trey lyrics and da da da, and all these stories about how you guys worked. And then I start doing this research, and you've won the Nobel Peace Prize in science. Congratulations for that. You went to the University of Hawaii. You've won the Charles C. Cheswick Prize. You spend your time at night wearing infrared goggles in your greenhouse, staying up all night watching mold spores replicate, and in the meantime you're jotting down the lyrics to Maze, you know, like, so you know, what's a little true false, what's going on here?
No wonder you're not sleeping.
So you fell into one of the internet traps that for whatever reason, and I never went back and like insisted it was purged or whatever, but there's like one or two interviews that were done to me, I thought tongue in cheek, about me, and these go way back. Like, I think one of them is 20 years ago, where I thought this guy, Dan Gladman, hey Dan, I've since met him, and he and I both laugh that some of the, you know, the fiction about that he kind of created, or that I maybe created, and I still claim inadvertently, is still out there. So if you Google me, you know, a certain way, I guess you can pretty much think that I am a biology professor, which has never, ever occurred. But all those other things were written by, that you just mentioned, that paragraph was written by Dave Abraham's wife, Luann. Hi, Luann, and hi, Dave. Luann, a long time ago, wrote that, and it's funny because Dave Abraham's is definitely attached to Trey's and my Princeton Day School growing up in music and Phish history. And when he married Luann, I wrote them some lyrics. We can talk about that later. I think she responded with that, and somehow that got out on the internet. So that's another one. People say, Tom, you went to the University of Hawaii. And sometimes I say, yep. And sometimes I disabuse them of that notion.
But I think that speaks to like the mysticism and the myth of Phish and the culture that surrounds it, that someone would come out and say he won a Nobel Prize, he's got a PhD in biology, he does all these things, and people go, ah, that sounds right. That sounds right.
There definitely is a myth. And when this stuff was written, the internet wasn't as, you know, powerful as it is today or as deep. And research by fish heads was, they were voracious fish heads wanting information. Information kind of was power about fish or whatever topic you were interested at the time. And information kind of was currency. And there wasn't a lot known about me. So, you know, and song meanings and that sort of thing. So, yeah, a lot of stuff when it got on the internet spread rapidly.
So just to, for my own 25 years of wondering, clarification of what I heard one day in a parking lot in probably Atlanta or somewhere. Did you ever fax Trey lyrics?
Oh, yes.
Have you ever?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I would say that we, you know, and that probably being the base technology. Actually, the base technology would be just telephone conversation. But then fax and then email and then, you know, now Dropbox where you can send an entire song to someone without batting an eye. We've written in every single possibility, every permutation there is.
So I kind of want to go back to the beginning, right? Normally, we do a whole interview with someone who's spent their life studying Woodrow Wilson. Then we say, well, how did you get on this path? You started so young. I think we need to start at the beginning, and you have so many varied interests. So tell us a little bit about growing up and how you met Trey and how this all started for you.
So I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, although I did spend a large chunk of my childhood in Sweden. Swedish was my first language. My dad was a electrical engineer and got his doctorate at Chalmers University in Gothenburg, Sweden. And then we moved back here and he worked at RCA. Actually, he has a patent on the first color TV, the vertical deflection circuit, which is in every TV or was in any cathode ray tube TV. And so I kind of like, for whatever reason, I've sort of gently pushed in the science direction. And, but that happened later really. But so anyway, I was in public schools in Princeton and then, started doing badly, I guess, in math. And even though I felt I had an aptitude in math and my parents felt the same. And so they started examining private schools and Princeton Day School was a full year ahead of the math program in the public schools. So I stayed back a year and it was actually kind of good for my social development as well. Because now I came in a confident eighth grader rather than a young eighth grader. I was the older, and that matters for boys, I think. But Trey, the exact same thing happened to him. He went from public school to Princeton Day School roughly at the same time, maybe a year younger than I did. I think he was there already. But I found myself plunged into 100. There were 50 girls, 50 boys, 100 people in this class, and there were 6 bands. And they all played music and I was the only keyboard player. So I was sort of playing in bands. We would play at parties and, you know, kind of Jumping Jack Flash type stuff or whatever. And we would spend a lot of time in basements trying to learn Genesis songs and stuff like that. And rapidly there emerged this sort of lead guitar. There were a lot of drummers and Trey was a drummer at the time. And there were a lot of lead guitarists. And Trey, in that interim, sometime in eighth and ninth grade, became without question from one of the okay drummers to by far the best guitarist in the space of 1 year. And everyone kind of like me was like, How do you know how to play guitar? It was like one of those stunning things. He picked it up and could play.
Can I just say that, like, what is this world you lived in where there were too many drummers in middle school and high school? Because when I grew up, everybody was looking for a drummer because nobody's parents would let them have a drum set in the house.
That didn't seem to be an issue. Yeah, everyone, all these people like Mark Dauber, Peter Cotone, Trey, they all had drums in the basement, and they all took lessons from the same dude. His name is High Frank.
That's awesome.
So you guys, you and Trey, have had this. Let's back up a second. What was the first song the two of you collaborated on, and when was it?
So definitely eighth grade. So this would be, I graduated high school eventually in 1982. So this would probably be 78. Closer to, could have even been 77 or whatever. My math skills are poor. But right around then, we were writing songs that were just designed to make the other person laugh. And I would say one of our very earliest ones was Wilson. So me and this guy, Aaron Wolf, who later featured his name, Aaron Wolf, was changed slightly into Trey's senior thesis, The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday, which talked about a land, Gamehenge, which is kind of a Narnia-like land, and has multiple songs that all became Phish staples. But Trey and I didn't know at the time that with Wilson, we had created the king of this evil land, the evil king of this land. And Aaron and I actually have the original Wilson written down. I'm looking at it right now, framed above my desk. And I wrote one verse and Trey wrote one verse. Aaron wrote one verse and we recited it, kind of sang it to Trey, and we recited it and sang it to multiple people. And the only person we would inevitably right after we sang it to them, we would giggle and then look at the person and say, "Do you get it?" And no one would get it. When we said, "Trey, do you get it?" He was laughing and he said, "Yeah, of course I get it." So that, he was the only one that like got it. So anyway, that song then later surfaced as a Phish song, which was kind of funny.
So you guys have been working together for a long time. How has that collaboration, we know it's changed with technology, right? But how has it changed creatively?
Well, Trey and I, so I was earlier telling you a little bit about like the cover bands. The other bands were really cover bands. So me and this guy, David Abrahams, whom I mentioned earlier, and Mark Dauber formed a band called And Back. And Trey rapidly attached himself kind of to us for a while and said that he loved our band because we wrote only original music. And so with that came sort of a beginning of an obsession with recording. And Trey was sort of a prolific worker. He anything he did, he would go at full speed. And as a result, he was like a great summer worker too. So he'd always have some cash and was able to buy a 4-track cassette player. And that was like this invaluable piece of equipment that we all kind of strive for. We knew that we wanted to overdub when we were writing songs and recording, but Trey kind of had one of the first ones. We all got one later, a TAC or Tascam or Fostex. But those were crucial to building a song, you know, piece by piece, as you guys well know as well. But that sort of, that's the pillar of Trey's and my songwriting, because even to this day, when we get together, there's a multi-track unit. And now we've expanded to 8 tracks, but we don't go beyond that because we find that having the limitation actually increases creativity, in that we have to be very careful to, you know, leave room for the final guitar solo or the final vocal harmony or whatever. And it really makes you think ahead, but it also puts a definite ending on the songwriting process, which is, we found to be incredibly important.
There's something to be said for scarcity.
Yes, absolutely. Too much is too much, and too little is just right sometimes when it comes to songwriting. I didn't answer your question though. So because of the that as our base, our most comfortable way of writing together in the same room with one of us pressing, you know, record and pause and record and pause and being the engineer, so to speak, while the other one is doing some kind of music rather than performing live, as Trey is also quite adept at. It kind of created this longing for us to write together in the same room. That's like our ultimate way of writing. But because of separation, Trey went to Taft and then on to Vermont, and I remained in the Princeton, New Jersey area. So we always had to write remotely. And because of his endless number of musical ideas, I knew that, and I had the same thing going on verbally. I would come up with lots of poem type ideas, song, just the words. I continued to stay in touch with Trey and would send him words, knowing that he was writing songs that needed words wherever he was in the world. And that actually worked out, you know, pretty good for me, because I became Trey's word guy that way, even though we were apart.
So what is it that you were, because, you know, you take things in life and then you create, and somehow in the subconscious of what you create, there are the seeds of from what you took in. So, you know, when you were in this, like, your late teens, your early 20s, when you and Trey were really starting to produce a lot of work, what were you taking in musically? What kind of books were you reading? What kind of movies did you like?
That's a great question. So, yeah, I always was a reader. My parents, I was one of the few kids, I think until the end of high school, my parents thought it would be pretty wise, knowing my propensity for distraction or procrastination, to not have a television in the house. So I was always behind the curve when people were talking about really cool TV shows and such, but it did help me in that I read a great deal. And by reading, my dad read to me when I was very young, and I kind of continued with the classics, like, you know, adventure stuff, Last of the Mohicans, Count of Monte Cristo, Three Musketeers, you know, that kind of stuff. Some of the Robinson Crusoe, all the, you know, those classics with often beautiful color plates in it. We have lots of those editions still. And he would just kind of go up to the bookshelf and pick one out and read it to me. So I think that sort of, also I was really into Edgar Allan Poe. My dad was too. It was sort of like this kind of weird obsession with creepiness, and H.P. Lovecraft as well. And so that sort of pervaded in my mind as well, and sometimes comes out lyrically. But I would fasten onto something people said or someone said in class, write it down, and sometimes that thought would go around in my head until it came out as lyrics.
So can I just and Ben, break in at any point, buddy, please. Cool, can I just throw a couple of songs, like three songs out there, and then you just give me in two or three sentences what you recall was going on in your mind, your life, when you wrote them?
Sure.
Stash.
That's funny you say that, because I'll start. This is kind of this funny thing between me and Trey, where I've told Trey that I would like to have had the opportunity to go back and rewrite some of these songs, especially some of the lyrics for the sillier songs. And if I say, like, Trey will go, inevitably he'll answer, and this is a conversation we've had 30, 40 times, he will say, which songs? And I'll say, Stash, Chalk Dust Torture, and he always feigns complete horror. He's like, those are my favorite songs and my favorite lyrics you've ever written. However, there's an element of cringe that I have, because I feel I've done better work lyrically, and that these might sort of be rhythmic lyrics or silly, extreme silly. And, you know, to my not to my horror or disappointment, but to my possibly dismay, whatever the weakest negative emotion, they became huge songs. And I mean, I'm proud of them as well. But, like, you know, Stash, Pulling the Pavement from Under My Nails, I Brushed Past a Garden Dependent on Whales, The Sloping Companion, I Cast Down the Ash, Yanked on My Tunic and Dangled My Stash, So there's probably not a whole lot in there or depending on how you look at it, there might be a lot in there. There's, you know, there's imagery, and I always like that. And Trey and I were always not about spoon feeding the listener any meaning. So we're not spoon feeding you any meaning with those lyrics.
I think people make their, and I see that with our songs, like the people, they make their meaning. They, you throw it out there and people, it filters into their lives and through their lives. So,
absolutely. But you can give them a better framework, in my view. It doesn't have to be just sort of like a canvas with a lot of holes in it. It could be, you know, at least an intact canvas.
They're like the artist must have put these holes in this canvas on purpose. And the artist is like, nope, just found it.
There you go.
How about my friend?
Okay. So it's funny. I foreshadowed this correctly, mentioning David Abrahams and his wife, Luann. Really good friends of mine. Unfortunately, they're in California, so I haven't seen them a lot, honestly, like in the last 15 years. But I spent a lot of time with David. And we both kind of got married roughly at the same time to girlfriends that we'd had for a long time. And David, Mark Daubert, and I, when we had the band and back, Mark was like a full 2 years older than us. And so he got his driver's license early, and we would drive around, and for whatever reason, we would yell stuff at people, you know, not mean stuff, but just yell strange things at people as we went by. It was also part of the songwriting experience, because things that got reaction, we decided to put into song. And it was also kind of like an inside joke. But one of them was, and this one actually these days, you know, would not fly. It wouldn't be politically correct. But David said to this, we didn't do this one a lot. This was not a good one. This was a negative one. But he kind of yelled at some guy, my friend, he's got a knife, as we went by in the car. And we cracked up because we thought it was funny. Like, you know, what would you do if you heard someone say, hey, my friend, he's got a knife, and then the car speeds by, right? What did we do to that guy's mental process that evening? We're not sure. But so when he got married, I gave him a knife, a beautiful, like a very, very awesome butcher's knife for his kitchen. And, you know, disregarding any superstition about giving a knife to a marriage as bad luck, I included this wedding wish. I said, my friend, he's got a knife, a statement from his former life when he was easy, but alone beside him was an empty throne. But what of silver silken blade affix his gaze, his features stayed, grasps the handle, clips the cable. One steps up, sits at his table. My friend, he's got a knife. My friend, he's got a wife. And that was the card that accompanied that wedding gift. So Trey, of course, got a hold of it and turned it into a song.
What? That's incredible.
This is so great. I'm just going to do one more, and I'm torn between two, but because Ben and I are conducting the interview, I'll be selfish, and I'm going to say my favorite song, the song that I whispered the lyrics to the song. Many days of my life, I've whispered the lyrics to the song to myself. Maze.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, now this was a amazingly, no pun intended, productive time lyrically for me, and Trey musically. And fortunately, again, our lives had kind of intersected where we were together enough that we could write some of it together. And then when we went apart again, he was living in Vermont at the time and I was living in Princeton, but I would travel up. We sensed there was some importance in this sort of canon of music, which we were hoping would create the next album. And so we wanted to be together when we wrote it. So we did, you know, Fast Enough for You and all these albums, all these songs that eventually wound up on the album Rift. I didn't as much believe at the time, but Trey, from an early, probably holding three completed songs, said, they all hook together. And they all are a common theme. And just keep writing, because whatever phase you're in right now, just keep writing, keep churning it out. And Maze is one of those that just sort of was flowing at the time. And it was really, any of you both are songwriters. Is that correct? I know you are, Bob, right?
Yeah. We've both written songs.
I was once upon a time. Now I'm a joke writer. Different story.
Okay. But in any case, sometimes you get lucky. The muse is right there over your shoulder and you just put pen to paper and it just flows. Maze is one of those. I was kind of thinking of being a little bit caught in a maze professionally. I wasn't really super duper happy with being a programmer, you know, in a cube, literally in a cube office on a floor where if you did look at it from above, it might have resembled a maze. You know, there's places people walk and then there's dead ends, which are the cubes where, yeah. And literally I felt I was in a dead end. So the overhead view is of me in a maze and you see what I'm hunting a few steps away and I take a wrong turn and I'm on the wrong path. And the people all watching enjoy a good laugh. That's sort of the philosophy. And so I just kept going. I think I wrote that song like in 10 to 20 minutes with very little editing. And Trey immediately loved it.
And I love the fact you said that he felt like the songs all went together, because one of the best album covers and inserts of all time is the Rift album insert, where he's, you know, it's got the maze and the rug and he's laying diagonal in his bed and all the songs are there in this beautiful painting.
That's amazing that you say that, because just yesterday, the day before yesterday, I was handed an incredible gift from a guy who waited in line for hours for the opening of David Welker's studio. David Welker is the artist of that original Rift album cover. And he's in New York City and announced the very limited, immediately sold out editions of a Maze artwork. And so a very good friend of mine decided that I needed that I needed one of those copies of Maze and gave it to me this past Saturday, 2 days ago. And it's so incredible. It's everything that's in that album cover and more. It's almost as if, because in that album cover, you can see a little hint of a labyrinth. It's almost as if then the camera goes and does a close up of what's in the maze. And it's kind of frightening what's in the maze.
So I think this is a great segue to talk about your life as a computer scientist. you are a scientist. You're not a botanist or an expert in biology, but you are compute. Let's talk about that a little bit, and then talk about some of the work you've done with that recently.
Sure. So right out of Rutgers, where I graduated with a computer science degree, I went into AT&T, and that's kind of where probably, you know, I got that perspective for the song Maze that we just discussed. But also there, I fortuitously ran into a guy named Scott Herman, and this was early in the email days, and we had two Unix servers that were connected by what was called Unix mail. So the email didn't go anywhere except within intracompany. And so we used it to determine, you know, where we're going to lunch and that kind of stuff. But then I started sending paragraphs of you know, poems to him and clips of poems and stuff. And before long, we were writing back and forth stuff and completely cracking each other up. And I like to say that one of the best products of that time period was the song Cavern, which again became a Phish staple. And that was written entirely like batting a tennis ball back and forth. I would write a couple lines, Scott would write a couple lines back and forth, to the point where we don't even remember who wrote what anymore. It was just this, it became sort of this epic journey of this hapless guy in a cavern and also over fields and fen. But so that was my AT&T experience. And then when I grew kind of tired of that, I sort of burned out there. I went to a place where Trey's father almost remarkably for some people when they hear this, Trey's dad was the CEO of Educational Testing Service, the people that bring you the SAT and the GRE and the LSAT and all those tests, standardized tests. Isn't that crazy that Trey's dad was the president of that?
Yes.
But he also served as a person that I could call up and say, hey, Ernie, I probably called him Mr. Anastasio, though, because back then I was younger and I needed a job. Is there a place for a C and Unix programmer in your, you know, in your organization anywhere? And he immediately got me into a really cool, really cool job, doing optical character recognition. So that was kind of my coolest job in my entire 18 years as a programmer. Didn't see Ernie much because he was, you know, way up in the corporate echelons, and I was doing the grunt work. But one thing that did happen, I've told this story before, so I'll just keep it extremely brief. My boss, kind of like my boss's boss, my manager's boss, was sort of this grumpy British gentleman from like a prior school of thought where you're supposed to be kind of a little bit mean and disconnected from your workers and run a tight ship and that sort of thing. And so our 45-minute lunch time was strictly enforced by him. And not only that, but he would do what we call bed checks, where he would come in at, you know, 1 minute to nine and make sure everyone was there. And then he would come also, he would do another sweep through at like 10 past five and make sure everyone was still there, that kind of thing. We call those bed checks. Then after the bed checks, then, you know, you could relax a little bit. But so this thing happened where we thought he was out or something. And earlier we had heard actually the boss himself describe how this great horned owl comes down and feeds on this really beautiful path that goes around the campus of ETS. And there would be very little time for us in 45 minutes to be able to make it all the way around. And so because he wasn't there, we decided to risk it, me, my friend Joaquin, and my friend Barry. And we were walking along this path. And who should be coming the other direction, of course, but the mean old boss. I'm not going to say his name because he's since passed away, and he is actually a distinguished gentleman. I wish him no ill at all. He had this incredible look on his face, like we just thought we were dead, like not just fired, but actually dead. the evil coming from him. And as he approached, it became apparent to me that he wasn't going to say anything, that it was just going to be one of these, like, yeah, just let the evil wash over us and you know what I mean? And then walk. And I wasn't having it. And so to my friend's extreme shock and horror, I said, looking for owls? And he wasn't expecting it at all. And his face became even worse, if you can imagine that. So, and then my friends were like, what the hell? Why? What the hell did you say to him? Why did you say that? I was like, well, that's probably why he was out there, right? I was trying to start a conversation. And they lambasted me for it. But that became a song called Buffalo Bill. It's like looking for owls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Fish plays it now and then. Oh, still. Wow. The lyrics go, looking for owls, the young man asked, hoping to lighten the tension, the scowl he received as his only reply made him smile as he relived the mention. And the cowering fool walked on alone, quite proud of the fear he instilled. And later they found him tied to a log, bent over and Buffalo Billed.
Oh my God.
Needless to say, that last part didn't happen, but that's what I was kind of thinking at the time. Might have been a good fate.
This is what I love about your life. And I don't know, because I'm a historian and I spend time writing and researching, but then I'm also a comic and I spend time writing jokes. And what I've found out so far, I've only been doing comedy for about 5 years, is that when I am working my hardest at research and being a good historian, that's when I write my best comedy material. And I think there's something about the, you know, when you go extreme on the one thing, you need that other extreme to balance you out. Do you feel like that?
I totally. Yeah, absolutely. I think what you're doing, you're opening this like the work area of your brain. And as such, it opens up other areas. So it's easier to access a particular type of thought or something along those lines. I always sort of try to envision on a science level what's going on in there. There's no real way to explain it. And, you know, probably 200 years from now, we will know the answer, or 300 or 400, because the brain is so incredibly complex. But that's sort of how I envision it. Yes, it's always when I've got something else going on that the best sort of lyrics spill out.
Hey, so let me ask you about your books.
So I published a picture on Twitter the other day of, and I called it the true Helping Friendly book, the true Helping Friendly books. So in, we talked about the mythology that follows Fish Around Gamehenge, which came from Trey's senior thesis, when he was at, Goddard University in Vermont. In that, there's sort of the Bible of the lizards, which are the people that inhabit Gamehenge, and that tome is called the Helping Friendly Book. So when I said the real Helping Friendly Book, I was being presumptive a little bit. But my friend Scott Herman from back in AT&T days that we discussed earlier, who helped me write a lot of fish songs, and I put together all of our email that might be useful, we thought, to Trey in songwriting. And we published it. We didn't publish it. We bound it and made 7 copies. And I have one. Scott has one. Trey lost 2 copies. And I don't know what happened to the other ones. And it was called The Salamander Prince. And a lot of fish songs were written from that book. So many so that then Scott and I caught up with each other again, even though now we're not in AT&T together. And we published another book called Walls of the Cave, which again sent Trey off into a writing spree, and many, many songs from Fish were written from that book as well, including its title, Walls of the Cave. And when I say that I have books, I think I tongue-in-cheek said that those are unpublished, but they're kind of published. What I meant by that was some of the contents is published as song. So I'm an author. I'm an unpublished author, but published in a weird way.
So why don't we talk about the podcast? So, you know, we joined the Osiris Network with you, and you have 2 shows on the Osiris Network. One is Under the Scales, and the other is The State of the Garden. What can you maybe tell us about those?
Sure. Under the Scales is using a little bit of my insider perspective and longtime friendship with the band. It kind of probes Fish's relationships, really. Like, I find people that have in some way been involved with Fish, whether currently or in the past, and talk to them. And so it's basically an interview show, and inevitably they mention music, and I'll try to play a little clip of whatever song that they're talking about at the time. And it became pretty popular. And so that's Under the Scales. And I'm currently in a little bit of a hiatus, but I'm digging my way out of that. I should be starting up soon again. And then State of the Garden is just getting started. There's only 3 episodes right now, but I have 4 interviews lined up next week for it. And it's supposedly going to document and talk about the legalization of cannabis in New Jersey. And it's something that I've gotten pretty heavily involved with right now. And so I'm talking to not only corporations and people trying to get into New Jersey as the cannabis industry takes off here, but also with sort of ancillary professions that you might not immediately, you know, recognize as being required. And for example, a lawyer and the type of law required to make this happen. And it's pretty fascinating, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
One of the big issues with marijuana businesses in states that's already been fully legalized is they can't put their money anywhere. They can't put their money in the bank because it's still federally illegal.
Correct. Yep.
So how are the businesses in New Jersey trying to overcome that?
I mean, it's a constant battle. So there's this a tax statute, and I hope I don't get this wrong, but I think it's called 280E. It's a
I think that refers to a paragraph or a chapter in the tax code on the federal level, and it affects states very much. And what it came about was from was a guy who, and I'm gonna learn more about this, so I'm speaking a little bit ignorantly, but I'm about to interview an expert in exactly this. And so, you know, I wanted to just remain a little bit ignorant so I could ask questions from a layman's point of view. But I'll give you a summary, and that is that a guy was dealing crystal meth at some point, and they were unable to bust him, you know, with possession or distribution. He was too smart for that. And so they thought they would pull an Al Capone on him and bust him for not paying taxes. However, it turned out that he was paying taxes on his money. And so there was no way to get him. And so when the IRS reviewed his taxes, they found that he was writing off every single expense. So like if he bought a plane, he wrote that off. So all his profits were he matched them with write-offs. So essentially his business made $0 and therefore he owed no tax, and he filed as such. So they couldn't catch him on tax either. So the way that they decided to go about catching him was create this new statute called 280E. And in it, they said, if you are doing any business that involves a Schedule I narcotic, you cannot write off anything against it. And so now that marijuana is being legal, however, remains on the federal list as a Schedule I narcotic, it affects legal businesses. And so we have to very creatively, for example, like a dispensary might try to get around it, because you're allowed to write off anything relating to selling stuff. So if you're a dispensary, you might find that they make a very, very tiny counter with only one person sitting on it, because that person and the counter itself and the space required in the building would be considered retail and cannot be written off. But everything else, if it's considered warehouse, can be written off as costs of goods sold. So that's a creative way they get around it. And yet it's like one of these weird legacy laws that are affecting us big time.
So I believe the other states, most of the other states that passed full legalization of marijuana, I believe New Jersey has medical marijuana. They did it by ballot initiative, right? Is New Jersey going to be the first state where the governor and the legislature actually make it fully legal?
Yes, we're kind of in a race, I think, with Vermont to be the first state that brings about full legalization legislatively rather than by ballot initiative. And that allows us to create, you know, correct some of the wrongs that other states, you know, and pitfalls they've fallen into, because, you know, we could get it right all at once and boom, it's just written into law. And to me, that's desirable. And it's kind of interesting as this occurs and the law is being written, watching it happen.
Yeah, because so many of the states like California, they do it by ballot referendum, and the legislation is so open-ended and it creates all types of problems. And then the people who don't like marijuana say, see, look at all the problems it created. And it's like, well, no, referendums have to be simple, and it takes a long time for a government to catch up to that. Whereas if you actually have legislators crafting policy, people who know the implications of certain laws, I think it's going to be way better. And so I hope New Jersey can get that worked out and kind of give us this great test case.
You just said it so much better than I did. That's exactly right. And one of the other sort of side effects of the ballot initiative and trying to get it right is that they repetitively and continually change the existing law. And that's bad. If you, for example, are a business person and you decide, hey, I'm going to, in Washington State or California, for example, I'm going to put all my money into creating a grow operation and, you know, using the laws as they exist right now. And boom, with one, you know, sweep of the pen, everything that you've, you know, used as your foundation legally can be changed. And I know fortunes have been lost, family fortunes, just, you know, with a stroke of a pen like that. So legislatively, we're hoping that kind of thing does not occur.
Well, Tom, it's I listened to the most recent State of the Garden yesterday, and it's an issue that's close to me, and I believe that we're heading towards at least full medical legalization and hemp legalization, whether Jeff Sessions wants it or not, New Jersey's my home state. I grew up in South Jersey. I lived there the first 25 years of my life. And so, really happy to see Governor Murphy make it into office. And I think he's going to do a lot of great things.
Nice. Absolutely. Us too. We're really encouraged with the current administration with regard to cannabis.
So let me ask, I got two last questions, Ben. I'm going to give you another chance to jump in here.
I'm just enjoying this. This is great.
Okay. Okay. You can't avoid, for me, who was a deadhead and then I got into fish that way, you can't avoid that comparison, right? The dead and fish, you can't avoid it. However, both bands are extremely different musically, lyrically, and generationally. What is your take on the culture that they share?
Despite being of the age of someone who could have started with the dead and then gone into fish, I don't have that. I don't share that history with a lot of my contemporaries who went to a whole lot of dead shows and were first dead fans and then became fish fans. To me, I think that's a slightly difficult journey. I think if you became a fully dead fan, that you probably in your head, you're constantly comparing them. Whereas I just fished, I was a blank canvas. And when fish went from zero to where they are today, I was there for every single one. And they've always been my band. The weird thing is I'm not a fan of a whole heck of a lot of other bands in the same genre. But so Trey took me to two Grateful Dead shows with Jerry. And then I think I went to another, two or three, and I thought, you know, they were great. But I never really was, a major Deadhead. I think, you know, you can compare the audience cause you can compare the obvious things are it's a band that you can tour and always get a different show. The hippie culture kind of is comparable, but musically I agree with you. There's very little comparison, and in a way you might be setting yourself up for disappointment if you strive to find one there, you know, a similarity there. But that said, all my Deadhead friends who love fish are really, you know, open-minded and are in music for, you know, getting their mind altered in a wonderful way musically. And there's no question that both bands do that equally well. It's just, just come at it slightly different ways, jam-wise and song authorship-wise.
So speaking of mind altering, you sent me a recording of Pink Floyd's Money. This morning when I listened to it with headphones, like somebody took a hammer, and it was the hammer of the gods, essentially, on my brain, and it was incredible. Incredible. What? Tell me about this. How do I get everything I listen to this way?
Oh, man. Well, oh, gosh. So, again, I could talk 2 hours about just this subject, but really, really quick. It was one of my first startup companies that I worked for. It was called now I'm going to get the name wrong. Soundwave 360. And basically what the invention was, it's a guy named, and he's still in Palm Springs. He's got his studio there. Hey, Paul Gilman, ladies and gentlemen, take your music to Paul. He's a great, great guy. Amazing, studio, engineer and producer. And, one of the inventions he came up with was, at the time, and this is possibly 15 years ago now, the, DVDs were big, and surround sound was this growing phenomenon. People were putting 5.1 systems in their houses to have home theaters. And the 5.1 was, of course, a subwoofer and then four speakers, and two of which were behind you. So someone at you know, one of the big music publishing houses got the idea that they will need to convert every single bit of recorded music into 5.1 to be fully enjoyable by these new surround systems, and began working on it. So you can find, and they, you know, they started with the most popular albums, including Dark Side of the Moon. And so there's probably something on the effect, I believe it's still under 1,000, but they released in 5.1 surround several of the most popular albums in the world. And Paul Gilman discovered this technique. He it's like, we only have two ears, right? We don't have five ears. We only have two, and yet we can discern where sound is coming from. And so he just realized that, you know, the placement of the speakers is what's creating the surround effect. And so he was able to, with software, replicate. He could take a 5.1 source, put it through his magic, and create surround sound from headphones. The only caveat, it doesn't work through speakers. It has to have the phone, the noise source has to be right at your ears for the math to work correctly. And when it does, it's breathtaking. It's like you can hear, you know, he did this thing where he was walking around the mics in his studio, and he literally walks around your head, and it's like your jaw will fall off. It's incredible. And so what you heard was the very beginning of the Pink Floyd song Money, where the cash register's opening and there's change falling, and then all that sound in the beginning of Money, every single one is coming from a different axis on the compass. And it's incredible.
Wow. It's amazing. I mean, everybody out there, you got to hear this.
I don't know how you can hear it. So the sad part of the story is, like all startups, we burn through all startups that fail. Our runway was too short. We burned through the $2 million that we raised. And we saw that our path, our mandate was to get this created, get this software burned into a chip and put into phones so people could listen to this on their iPods at the time or their phones. And that never happened. We burned out. And
well, why didn't you go on Shark Tank?
Yeah, maybe now we should. Paul, if you're listening,
we need to call Mark Cuban.
Yeah, let's
call Mark Cuban. Let's get him in on this.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so I was watching MSNBC recently, and Katie Turr was the host, and Jake Sherman, who's a great reporter for Politico, were on, and they started throwing fish lyrics back and forth coyly when they were doing their reporting back and forth. They start throwing fish lyrics back and forth. Well, how does that make you feel? I mean, I remember, you know, there was a time when it was interesting that, like, Pat Leahy's an old deadhead, and you had Al Franken in Congress, and you have all these, like, a lot of, and Republicans and Democrats, like, a lot of old deadheads are in Congress. And now we're starting to see fish fans rise through the ranks to have, I mean, really, both Katie Turr and Jake Sherman are two of the best reporters out there today. So how does that make you feel to have your words being thrown about in a completely different world?
Equal parts awe, honor, and incredible humor, just hilarity, you know, because the way they're so adept at the way that they put them in, that you don't have to know that you were just recited a fish lyric. And I love that. And I think it's amazing. And the fish twibe on Twitter goes nuts whenever it happens. So I always get to see the replay if I miss it in real life. Funny thing was, I got to meet Katie Turr. She was at the New Year's fish show. So I met her in New York recently.
It's really funny, because the first time it happened, I was like, I was listening to it in the car on Sirius XM. And I was like, wait a minute.
Did that just happen? Exactly.
Yeah, and so it's always a lot of fun when you kind of catch it. And,
hey,
and
it's awesome. I know we're running out of time. Maybe we should have, like, maybe in 6 months we talk again, because I didn't get to talk to you guys, interview you guys about your amazing podcast. And the two that I just most recently listened to were the the Blood Moon book about the Cherokee Nation and the two sort of leaders of that nation and what happened there. That was amazing. And then on a equally serious note was your guys' discussion of the Armenian genocide, which I didn't know enough about at all. And that kind of proves the premise of the topic, is that that was kind of, in a weird way, attempted to be covered up. And please listen to those, anyone listening to this, but maybe we should talk about them at some future date.
We talked about fish. We talked about history. We talked about historical fiction. We talked about Antarctic exploration. We spoke about a 360 startup. We talked about marijuana legalization. Tom Marshall, you may be the most interesting man in the world.
He's the Renaissance man, Ben. That was my premise.
You guys are too kind. I'm gonna play this for my wife on endless loop, you know?
It never works.
Well, yeah. Never to the wife. Never. Doesn't matter what accolades you receive. It's, you're still the guy that needs to take out the trash, and you didn't do this and this.
Exactly.
And
then
you did that, but you didn't do it right. But I love you anyway, and you're my hero. I love you, but I can tell you everything that you just did not do quite up to snuff. But that's what love's all about. But she loves you, Tom. She loves you more than anyone else in the world.
That's good to know. Wow, Phil, thank you. I was going to say, you must have had a mic. There must have been a mic on this morning.
No, it's called the honeymooners theory. It's like, it's universal. So
yeah, your wife will just be like, wow, an hour and a half on everything you did do. Let me do a 6-hour podcast on everything you didn't do, Tom.
That would be free flowing, and she'd never stop. She wouldn't even need to breathe. She would just talk. Yeah.
Tom Marshall, this has been an afternoon well spent. Thank you so much for your time.
I really, really appreciated it. And I love your guys' podcast. And I'm so happy you guys are part of the Osiris family. And it's been an honor to appear on your podcast. And I can't wait to meet you guys in person.
And everyone remember, Osiris, we're a community of podcasts out there. And check us out and go to osirispod.com.
There it is. All right. Well, thank you, guys.
That was amazing, Tom. Thank you.
Have a great afternoon, Tom.
How can I enjoy the day with morning standing in my way? Just for once, I'd like the right to skip directly to the night.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer and Ian Scotta. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, Jeff LeCane, and Linda Thamer. If you'd like to join us on Patreon and get extra content, go to roadtonow.com and click on support at the top of our page. Keep up with us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @road_2_now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and a 5-star rating and a few kind words does a lot to help us get the word out. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.